Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 13 of Hometown Glory, your Spurs and Culture podcast. I'm Charlie and I'm delighted to be back with you all. I'm joined by Rosa and Tom for this one. How incredibly exciting. Now, plenty to get through since this podcast last convened. We'll, of course, be running the rule over an emotionally confusing defeat at home to Liverpool on the weekend, while considering all things Champions League after our Marseille heroics and the draw for the last 16. Now, Rosa and Tom, let's go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium for Spurs 1, Liverpool 2 from Sunday. It was a game in which we went 2-0 down for the fourth consecutive Premier League match. It was a game in which we failed to score a goal in the first half for the seventh consecutive match. And it was a game in which, of course, we lost. But there were some positives to take from another home defeat in the league, which we're very much going to cling to shortly. But Tom, you were the only one of us that were there, that was there at the stadium on the weekend for various reasons. That first half, again, what I want to talk about with the first half was it wasn't a classic sort of miserable recent times Spurs first half and that we just didn't show up. Because aside from the two sort of comically poorly defended goals, we were kind of all right, weren't we?
I think we played fairly well first half, yeah. But, you know, we should have known better than to give Salah space and time on the ball. Those two goals were right in front of the south stand. The second was obviously a pretty massive error by Dyer. The fullbacks were extremely patchy in that first half, really. But yeah, we weren't terrible by any means. But, you know, we know what Liverpool are like. We know what Salah's like. He's one of the best players in the league, even if his form slightly dropped this season. We should have known better. But yeah, we weren't bad. It wasn't an absolutely terrible first half. If we'd have gone in 1-0 down at half-time, that would have been lovely. Mm. And we could have taken it, I think. But switching off, what was the second goal? 30, like almost 40 minutes, right? We just had to get to half-time at that point and regroup and know that we're always more intense in the second half, or we certainly have been, for, like you said, the last 10 games or whatever. We had to get there 1-0 down and we didn't. But yeah, overall, I thought we were good. I think the crowd were good. I know a lot of people have moaned about the crowd in the stadium this season, and there were some boos when we went in at half-time 2-0 down. But considering we were losing from the 10th minute, I think the crowd were really good, and they, you know, we reflected that intensity in the second half and kind of, you know, we came out all guns blazing in the second half. And overall, we probably deserved a draw were it not for Salah, I suppose.
It's interesting you bring up the crowd and the booing and just the general mood around the stadium particularly, because obviously Conte was asked about the booing and said that it wasn't something that he was especially thrilled about. He said he understood it, but basically kind of intimated that it's not especially helpful in his opinion. I then saw Graeme Souness talk about the atmosphere in the stadium as well, not being what he felt it should be in terms of getting behind the team, all that kind of stuff. I feel like on this podcast, we're all fairly robust in our booing is never particularly helpful. Rosa, from your trips to the stadium this season, and just, I guess, as a Spurs fan that has encountered many, many situations where booing would be entirely fair and appropriate, where do you stand on, like, when is acceptable to sort of do the whole, you know, Real Madrid waving the white flags, booing stuff?
Okay, just one quick thing in response to what Tom was saying, which is that we should have known better really needs to be our new club motto, don't you think? Just here we go again. And also massive error feels like it's actually slightly too kind to Eric Dier. I'd actually avoided watching that at the time because I just wasn't looking at the TV at the time of said error. And when we conceded again, I was like, I just left the room and, you know, came back in for the second half. But I refused to watch the goal. And then Ollie made me watch it this morning. And it genuinely was worse than what I've been imagining. So,
well, it's particularly hideous because I'm not even sure what had his attempted header come off. I'm not even sure.
I know, it would have been a nightmare as it was.
What was the best case scenario that he was hoping for there, that it sort of went back to them, but further up the pit anyway?
I think this is it again, like brain freeze, also too kind. Stadium wise, I've got really not completely mixed feelings, but some mixed feelings. So my feeling about booing in the stadium is I feel like it's a bit like having a family argument in public. But I feel like maybe other people think it's just like having an argument with your family at home. So I just think there's just two different attitudes to that. I'm like, let's not embarrass ourselves and let's not show everybody what we're stressing about. Exactly. So
business.
Just keep it to yourselves. But I guess people think, well, it's our stadium. That's our family. That's our home. That said, even within that context, even if you feel like it's all right because it is your home, it's just... And I said this on Twitter, it's obviously cathartic in the moment to boo your players if you're frustrated, but it's just so, so, so counterproductive. And I don't understand how there's anybody left who doesn't see that. And I don't know how many times players can come out and managers can come out and say, it's really helpful if you cheer us, you know, and leave the other part unsaid because they don't want to actively say, please don't boo us. It's really stressful and doesn't help. So, you know, we don't have to be like a German fan base and like sing all the way through and cheer everything they do, and they clearly don't deserve it. But I think this is just madness at this point, and it doesn't, and it's just actively hurting us. And I also think in the specific context of the game against Liverpool, it's also crazy because Tom's right. We had a very ropey first. It was almost like our bad first half was condensed into the first 10 minutes. And after that, we were fine, bar that, you know, moment of madness. We didn't deserve to go in at the break 2-0 down, which we have done in basically every other game where we've been 2-0 down. So at this point, I'm like, is it just one of those things where, like, when you know, come across people on Twitter and it's just like booing's your personality now? I don't know.
I wonder if we've gone a bit boo mad because we, through our booing, we essentially got Nuno fired, right? So maybe we think that actually we are, you know, the power to the booing people. But no one, I refuse to believe no one actually wants, regardless of how kind of insatiable Spurs Twitter can get after a defeat, I refuse to believe that anyone still actually wants Antonio Conte to not be Spurs manager right now. So surely people don't want to, like, you know, spark some sort of Conte meltdown that's actually going to lead him to think, actually, they don't even want me here, so I'm off. That's just like you said, counterproductive is exactly the word I would use for it.
Maybe you're right. They are sort of like drunk with power. You know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, guys. Let's just think, let's remember that.
I've said it before on the, I think I said it on the last podcast, but the, you know, we went into the game third in the league yesterday. Like, you can't, like, well, yeah, what do you want? You can't, you don't want Conte out. Like, well, some people do, but they're mental. But yeah, I have mixed feelings. People pay their money. You know, everyone in that ground has paid a lot of money to be there. I don't boo personally. I think I probably booed Nuno, a couple of those Nuno performances and some Sherwood performances at points. But it is counterproductive and it is embarrassing because you know Conte is going to be asked about it and the media are going to, you know, understandably, newspapers are going to ask about it and people are going to make a bigger deal of it than they should. What, like, I didn't see what Souness said, but certainly second half, our support was brilliant. And actually, from the South Stand, I didn't hear Liverpool's fans until injury time at the very end when they realised they'd won it and they started making some noise. So I do think, actually, the atmosphere was pretty, pretty good, considering we were losing for almost the entire game.
Psychologically, at this point, these starts we're making are, you know, they're a big issue. They're really sort of hampering our progress now in a big way. What can be done about it? Rosa, I feel like I want to come to you as our sort of in-house psychologist for this kind of stuff. How do you stop players playing? Because they seem to be playing sort of within themselves in the first half because they are scared to make mistakes. They seem to there. And I think Kane alluded to this after the Marseille game when asked about the first half, in the sense that, you know, he's aware that the team sort of just drops further and further back when they're under pressure or they don't want to make mistakes. Because I guess it's, you know, the closer I am to my own goal, the safer I am, sort of thing. What do you think? And I'm sure this is obviously a question that Antonio Conte and his team are asking themselves every minute of the day at the minute. But what can happen to, you know, maybe we won't use the Forest game midweek as an example, as that feels like a bit of a free hit perhaps, but Leeds on the weekend in the league, which suddenly feels like an enormous match for us to win, hopefully to go into the World Cup on a high with. How do you send them out to that stadium on Saturday afternoon, full of energy, full of that sort of second half vim and vigour that we're showing?
I mean, I think we are Conte's biggest challenge, and that's the reality of the situation that he is in and that we're all in. When I think one of the things that people sort of get wrong about, this is going to sound so pretentious, I'm really sorry, bear with me. One of the things people get wrong about psychological therapy, psychotherapy, all of that form of treatment, is that you start things when you're feeling pretty, pretty low and you get a sort of immediate sense of feeling better at the beginning. And then what happens to pretty much everybody as you go through it, kind of other, you're sort of digging a bit deeper and other things start coming up. And there comes a point where you're like, oh my God, this isn't helping at all. I actually feel worse than I did when I started. And you have to stick with it. I mean, you don't have to, lots of people don't, that's fine. But if you do, then there comes a point where you don't feel that bad again and you never feel that bad again. But there are always going to be times when you kind of fall back into things, because that's just the reality of the human mind and human emotions, the human psyche, right? And I just think footballers are human beings and they work in that sort of weird network where they're all playing off each other, and whatever kind of team dynamic kind of fits into our sort of club dynamic. And I don't, you know, I'm really against all of the sort of people who are like, oh, we're just kind of doomed to failure and all the, you know, Dr. Tottenham stuff and all of that. I don't believe in any of that, but I do think we really are a neurotic fan base and we're quite a neurotic club, and it's just going to take a lot more time. I think what we had basically at the end of last season, and when Conte arrived, we had that initial bump And it pushed us, it kind of pushed and dragged us over the line for fourth. And now some of the familiar issues are coming back up. And I don't think they have to be there forever. I think with a lot of work and an acceptance, they are going to kind of come back up, that we are going to get nervous and kind of shrink back into ourselves. I think that can be defeated. I really, really believe that. But I just think it's not going to happen overnight. And I think I understand why people get really upset, because it looked like Conte kind of sorted that out and he'd made us kind of more, much more robust. And then to watch the sort of old frailties kind of raise their ugly heads again is really depressing. But it's just, I don't think it's something that's, I don't think it means that this is it and everything's going wrong. I think it is just, it's just the sort of natural ebbs and flows of human experience. So I'm very sorry. That was really pretentious, but that is genuinely what I think.
No, I was hoping for something that pretentious from you. Oh, so that was, I thoroughly enjoyed that. Is perhaps though, we're talking about a football club where, you know, a shortcut perhaps to, you know, putting some sticking plasters or indeed full surgery on a team sort of psychology, or, you know, getting past these frailties is by simply swapping some of the players that simply seem to be beyond psychological aid at maybe this stage, after 7, 8, 9 years of watching certain players make very similar mistakes every, you know, few weeks / months. Are we at that stage now where we have to, you know, obviously we've been sort of enduring quite a, as to go back to sort of Poch's old thing, you know, the painful rebuild has been happening now for sort of 3 or 4 years. We still have a few mainstays from that era, even almost before that era. Is it now time where we look at certain players that are still pretty much in the first team every week? And I hate talking about certain players because I feel like they're also some of the most beloved players we have. But, and even if we're not talking about them leaving the club necessarily, is the fact that some of these guys are sort of almost first name on the team sheet guys that we literally don't have replacements for, in the case of someone like, say, Eric Dyer, who, to be completely fair to Eric, was in tremendous form for almost the entirety of Conte's reign, up until pretty much that England recall where things have fallen off dramatically. But, and, you know, we obviously hope that he's going to turn that around. But do we need to, I guess what I'm asking is that last little nudge that we need as a club to sort of move on from certain players, because we're almost holding on to them as like, well, they're great guys and we love having them here and, you know, they're good dudes to have around the place. Do we just need to like rip that Band-Aid off?
I think it's worth mentioning like certain circumstances under like beyond our control as well. The World Cup is an issue. Hulu being injured has been a massive issue. It's frustrating that our £60 million signing hasn't contributed anything yet. In the league, at least, in the Champions League, he's got a couple, and has been injured. And then, you know, Dyer, I know you're sort of, you know, I think we probably do need to upgrade from Dyer, but he does look a million times better with Romero next to him. And whether that's a genuine injury or sort of World Cup related or a bit of both, I don't know. But I think like we have to look at this half of the season with those things in mind, because they are all contributing factors. But yeah, it's a worry. Like, our form and that first half form especially is a worry when it's so competitive for the top four this season. But yeah, I do agree, like, you know, there were players on the bench yesterday that we should have got rid of ages ago. You know, Davis and Longole should probably be backups along with Dyer at this point, and plus Royale, like, Jesus.
But I don't really think, I mean, obviously I've got my own, you know, biases here, but I just don't really feel like those players are necessarily the problem. If I look at the players that I'm just more frustrated in kind of week in, week out, you know, it is players like Emerson who are just, I can't be bothered with them anymore. And I don't really have, and maybe it is because I do have, you know, long-standing affection for certain players who have been at the club a long time, and I don't have that for Emerson. You know, he's a player where I'm like, I don't care about you anymore. And even actually, and oh my God, this is, maybe if we're talking about long kind of long-serving players. You know, Lucas, even though I've always said I want him to kind of have the freedom of the city when it comes to our club.
I don't think that's controversial.
But it's controversial in my heart, Charlie. Like, I feel terrible. I know he's like a weird guy.
He loves fascists. Come on, it's fine.
I know, but like, he gave us literally the greatest moment of our, you know, footballing career, like our Tottenham supporting careers. But honestly, he's not an option, is he? Like, no. If you need an attacking option, he's not your guy. I mean, you could see it on Sunday. Was it yesterday? I had to lose track of all time. When Kulu came on, and it was like, this is what happens when you have a good player. Yeah, that's it.
It was remarkable. And we should talk about Kulusevski, because we're at risk of getting a little bit zoomed out in our sort of treatment of what's going on with Spurs at the minute, which is entirely my fault. But Kulusevski on the pitch for what was it, like
a minute,
110 seconds or something before he slipped in Kane for the goal to get us back into the game. And you're right, Rosa, he came on. This guy hasn't played football in a couple of months now. He's missed so much. Just did not skip a beat immediately. And also just looked so confident and was like, I'm what this team needs. Like, not just that, oh, where can I fit in? Where can I help? Like, is there anything I can do, guys? Like, what's needed? It was just like, give me the ball, I'll sort this out.
And he just wants to make things happen, doesn't he? And, you know, talking, Lucas, I mentioned the bench there where, like, we should have cut our losses on Sanchez and Tanganga and Lucas some time ago, really, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
But, like, Lucas comes on and looks like a headless chicken and, like, doesn't look up, doesn't really know what he's doing.
No final product,
makes a decent run occasionally. But, like, Kulu comes on and is like, he wants to make things happen. He is smart. Like, he sees runs, he sees space, he sees passes, he links with, like, Kane and whoever's at right back. He links with players.
And Doherty look brilliant. Him and Matt Doherty look absolutely telepathic in their understanding of where the other wanted the ball.
They've not played together for months. We've missed Kulu so much. And yeah, like you said, he comes on and immediately wants to make something happen. And, you know, he hasn't got anything to prove. Like, he's not trying, like, he's so young, he just wants to get on and make things happen, and there's no, like, no sort of baggage. He doesn't come with any baggage. There's nothing sort of,
yeah,
he's not carrying anything on his back.
To kind of hark back to a bit of what Rosa was saying, he doesn't really know any of the Tottenham neuroses, because he arrived, aside from maybe his first few weeks where he looked a little bit tentative on the ball and like it was, you know, taking him a minute to understand where he was. All he's known is Tottenham sort of roaring back from the abyss to grab fourth place under Antonio Conte and good times. And even he's even missed the rubbish bit by being injured. So he just, you know, all he knows is about Spurs being assertive and winning football matches. And I think he's just so good. And just how confident he looked, I just thought to myself, do you know what? Like, his form before wasn't just a kind of flash in the pan, or it wasn't just he's like taking the league by storm, but teams are going to work him out. He's really, 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 really good. And he is going to be, you know, he's going to be our star player, I think, for a long time if we can keep hold of him. I think when we look beyond the sort of Kane Son sort of peaks, and I think, you know, we are starting to look down the road a little bit and see what a future might look like without them both for different reasons, form and because Kane might piss off at some stage. If we can keep a hold of him, I think we've got, you know, someone that could become one of the best players in European football. I really, really do. And I think the same with Bentancur. I think, you know, I'm so upset I've not been on the podcast to rave about Rodrigo Bentancur for the last 3-4 weeks, because the step up that he has taken since basically we've become a bit rubbish and he has just put the team on his back is extraordinary. And I thought, again, against Liverpool in the second half, he just was like, right, okay, if I have to dribble past four players, I'm going to dribble past four players. If I have to make a slide tackle to win the ball back, I'm going to make a slide tackle to win the ball back. If I get booked, whatever, like, just whatever it takes. And Christ almighty, if we can bring in two players like that in January, top four, I don't think it'll be any issue whatsoever.
He sets a tempo, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Bentancur, and like Kulu is one of those players who absolutely matches without Son on the pitch, especially like Pulu just is there once his energy is just crazy.
Yeah, I don't think any of that can be overstated, really, because I think, I mean, certainly not with Bentancur, but with Kulu, I was quite nervous, like, you know, for the like 2 seconds before he like actually, you know, came, like walked onto the pitch. Because I just thought, you know, he's been out for a while with, you know, the sort of mystery Tottenham ailments that we have. But, and also because his form had kind of wobbled a bit, right, in the kind of early weeks of the season. It wasn't quite.
He got dropped as well for Richarlison, didn't he? Who, you know, every time Richarlison had come on had been brilliant, and then he kind of lost his place, which it was really almost harsh on him because he hadn't done anything wrong.
And it was almost to keep Son in the team, wasn't it? If I think back, it was Conte sort of, I have to let Son play himself into form. Richarlison keeps coming on and making an impact, but I can't play Richarlison in his sort of Everton position on the left. So I'm going to have to sort of crowbar him into the right and take away one of the most productive cutting in from the right players in Europe, which looking back now seems completely insane.
It seems mad, actually, because the way he just kind of waltzed onto the pitch after half time was just... It was just so dynamic and confident and strong, and as if he'd never been injured, as if he didn't know what injury was, or as if he didn't know what kind of dip in sort of confidence or form was. I just thought, you know, you're right. That's a man who just is not like on any sort of speaking terms of angst whatsoever, despite being from Sweden.
the other massive positive for me in terms of player performance was Yves Bissouma. I think that was the first time, and he's had flashes. I thought the Everton game, he looked quite good when he came on and we moved formation, and him coming into the midfield sort of won the game for us. I thought at Marseille last week, he looked pretty good too. But I think this was the first time where I was like, there is that dude that turned up with Brighton 2 times last season, not just once, 2 times, and ran the midfield, and you couldn't get the ball off him. He was comfortable taking the ball forward and sort of, you know, stepping past people. He felt strong, like so much stronger on the ball than he's looked, where before it looked like he could get sort of blown over by a stiff breeze. When now it's like he kind of remembered that he's this sort of super tough little midfielder that can, you know, can bounce off people, and a real lift. And I think going back to what Tom was saying in terms of like, not really seen that much from too many of the signings and people like Son. I think I would add Bissouma to that list of, do you know what? Like, we've played 14 league games. So, and I think Billy reminded us when we were, you know, kind of having a emotional set to in our group chat this morning, we're all talking about second half of the season. We've only played 14 games. There's actually, you know, there'll be 15 after Leeds. So there's a bit more than half of the season to go. So we're not quite at the halfway stage yet. So there's plenty of games to come. And the fact that Bissouma finally looks like he's gonna be ready to step up, I thought was massive. And Rosa, you've spoken a ton about this, right? Where we just expect players to come in, particularly players like Bissouma, who's been playing in the Premier League for a long time, at also a very high level. It's totally different. Like, the expectations are different. He's playing under a very different coach. He's got completely different teammates. I think Conte and us on the podcast have sort of alluded to this idea that perhaps from the sounds of it, he was afforded sort of big man on campus status at Brighton, where he maybe didn't have to put in 110% effort, but always knew he was going to be in the team every week. I think this is a perfect case in point of sometimes it just takes players 3 months or whatever, and bang, here you go.
I feel totally vindicated because he was fucking brilliant, let's be honest. And you're right. And he was building up to it over the past, three games that he'd been involved in. But he was magnificent. He did this sort of Dembele-esque absolute madness at one point, where he just shrugged off like 3 players, turned and like managed to find somebody for a pass that I honestly wanted to applaud it. It was so, so glorious. We knew he had it in him because we've seen him play for Brighton. and we knew he was struggling. And, you know, sometimes things just don't work out for certain players at certain clubs. It happens. But it really hadn't been that long since he joined. And we are a club still, so, you know, we're working things out as a club, right? Mm. So where do you, as a player, if you're kind of arriving into a situation that's still sort of slightly chaotic, kind of how do you find your place really in there? And also, we know how seriously Conte takes the midfield and what he wants his midfielders to do.
And how,
there's
just, and how
there's no fucking about in there.
Yeah, and how established Bentancur and Højbjerg as well. So it's a hard duo to break.
But also the levels that their performances have hit. Mm. You know, I know obviously Bentancur has absolutely been the player of the season, but Højbjerg is not that far behind, really. And you got, so it's not even really like slotting into our defense, which, you know, we all know
has, anything would be an upgrade.
Yeah. you don't have quite so much to prove there, but those are the guys you're up against. Those are the guys you've got to say, I'm as good as them. And he is, you know, it's just about sustaining it basically for him, yeah. I think
for whatever reason, I hadn't seen much of Bissouma this season for us. I think the games when he's played, I've been out and about. I haven't caught them on TV. Seeing him in person for the first time yesterday, I did that first 10 minutes when we were kind of terrible and couldn't get on the ball. I did have that worry that he's one of these players that we buy from a club who's the, like, you know, the star player, the team is built around them, at another, you know, mid-table club potentially, and just can't cut it with us. I know we were talking about Pienaar and Dempsey earlier, and, you know, we've had a fair few of those players over the years who just can't kind of
step. Maligned and should have been given more of a chance, let's be honest.
But yeah, that first 10 minutes I was panicked, and then actually seeing him in the flesh, seeing his work rate, his positioning, he was absolutely excellent yesterday. And again, it allows Bentancur to do that amazing roaming thing that he does, where he skips past four players, and, you know, if he's got Bissouma and Højbjerg behind him, then you don't need to worry. And I think there were a few times yesterday where obviously we had Perisic playing off Kane. There were a few times where Bentancur almost slipped into a front three with them before Kulu came on, when we were on the ball. And yeah, I don't know, like he's got it all, hasn't he, Bentancur? I know he didn't really score goals before he came to us, but he's got a couple. And yeah, seeing him flying forward, you're like confident that he'll find his man and pick out a pass. But yeah, agreed. Bissouma was excellent yesterday, and having three centre mids was great. Worked well for most of the game.
But also, if we're thinking about things that you know, we'd really, it's interesting because we did lose, and it was an absolutely gutting defeat. I was properly crushed at the end.
I just
want to focus in on that before, you know, we can kind of get into our feelings a little bit in a minute if we want to, maybe we don't, I don't know. But just to kind of think about even more of the positives, just mentioning that Bentancur just didn't really score before and he's scoring for us, I think that is such a good omen for us. Because usually that's the kind of thing that just happens the other way around, doesn't it? And you just have players who kind of score loads and they come to us.
Same with Højbjerg.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
They're both chipping in almost every other week. Like one of them is now, you know, we haven't spoken about Marseille because the Liverpool game sort of overtaken absolutely every waking Spurs thought we've had. But, you know, look at Højbjerg in that game. Like, who would have thought last season? Mm. I just don't think he would have, or the season before that, he would not, in that situation, put through on goal in a really tight, sort of tight angle, defender breathing down his neck, last minute of added time. I would not have put money on him pinging it into the top corner. Whereas, you know, our central midfielders, guys, they're scoring goals. We haven't had it for years.
But we really need it though, don't we? Because we haven't had enough from Richarlison, Son.
Yeah.
Kulin.
Lisevski's been out. He's only scored once that first game of the season. Yeah.
Even Perisic, who I think has been mostly good, could have contributed goals now.
I thought yesterday he obviously hit the woodwork twice yesterday, nearly getting them.
And the fullbacks as well should have had more assists particularly. So thank God for those centre mids. One more positive from yesterday. I thought Perisic was really good. Again, his work rate's ridiculous for someone who's almost as old as me, and I can barely get out of bed in the morning.
He wins the ball back in the opposition half so much. It doesn't matter if he initially loses it. He's so strong and clever and sort of wily that he's just like, I'll just pinch it back again and we'll start this again. Like, it's so rare to see in sort of top class professional football, I think, just someone that is so capable of just like going, I'll have that back. Like, you can't have the ball, I'm going to have it back now. Because he's just so strong and smart, and I just fucking love him. And I cannot stress enough like how much better we look with him on the left wing. Like, I thought yesterday when we had him and Doherty and Kulusevski on the pitch, those crosses just sort of raining down on Liverpool, I just thought to myself, we are going to, second half of this season, we are going to score so many goals from crosses if we can have Kulusevski and Perisic on the pitch at the same time. Because Perisic is basically, at this point, he's kind of good for an assist a game just from his crosses. Like, if he doesn't do anything else, as long as he's taking corners and free kicks, you're almost assured of a goal because they are so good. And I mean, I thought Longley was actually pretty good again yesterday too, but that header that Longley missed right, you know, it was like 3 yards from goal. I mean, Tom, you must have been right over the top of it in the south stand. That corner from Perisic was just, you can't defend corners like that. They're whipped in. Those in-swingers, I've just wanted us to have someone that can play that type of set piece for years. It's felt like years and years and years since we've had someone like that. And you can't defend them. And I just feel like, you know, get Richarlison back in the team. Kane's obviously going to eat when it comes to headers. Bentancur seems like he's now winning headers from corners and things. Like, get, you know, I just feel like that could, and obviously we have scored a ton of goals from set pieces, but getting Kulusevski in the same team as Perisic could be so huge for just the amount of chance creation we'll get from crosses. Anyway, that's my crosses rant.
It's almost like when we've got all of the good players that we have in our squad, when they're all like fit and playing, we're really good.
It's mad.
It's crazy how football works like that. This is what Billy always says though, isn't it? It's just like, football's really simple.
Brian Hill and Lucas Moura as our, you know, complementary forwards. We can actually do something. It's insane.
I wish you hadn't reminded me of that Longley because I'd had thought that was right near the end of the game, wasn't it? And a random guy punched me in the arm. I think an old boy had kind of been going to leave, and we're the end of the row right by the gangway. I don't know if he was going to leave, and then the corner happened. He sat next to me in the spare seat and then punched my arm when that happened. Like, thanks, mate. I don't even know who you are. You're punching me. But that was the chance, wasn't it? Like, that was the chance.
And
loads of chances, Matt. I know, like, that was the most clear cut. But honest to God, we deserved a draw. And there was a moment when I like finally realized it just wasn't going to happen for us. I think when they got it back and they had a free kick, and I was like, okay, that's that. Yeah. But honestly, right up until that moment, and I swear to God, that was about 5 seconds from time.
I was the same.
Right up until that moment, I was like, we could still do this. And that feeling, I've gone from really pretentious to being like proper football man again. I'm like, that's massive.
Love you, Rosa. Get you a Rosa that can do both.
Exactly. But it's huge, isn't it? You know, just knowing that however crap your team is in the first half, that come like 95 minutes, you'll be thinking we could still draw or win this.
And it was the opposite of the Newcastle game, and it certainly was the opposite of the United game at Old Trafford, where it felt like there was, you know, we could have played for another 3 hours without scoring another goal. Whereas, yeah, I think if we'd have had another 5 minutes on the weekend against Liverpool, we absolutely would have equalised.
Let's be honest, we should have drawn because we should have had a penalty.
Yeah, I'm still not 100% sure that was a penalty, but we don't.
Okay, but if it's a penalty the day before,
and it was the same. Did I read that it was the VAR ref for the City game or something?
So. I don't want to be tinfoil, but they're making it impossible not to be. I'm sorry. It's crazy, crazy decision.
I think that's been a good cathartic session talking about that game, because I think, obviously, Rosie, you're totally right. I think every Spurs fan I know was really quite bereft at the end of it, because it felt like a big opportunity for a statement win over a sort of ailing Liverpool that certainly aren't what they have been. We would have gone 13 points clear of them had we won. It's now pretty different and the top four race looks like a bloodbath. But I think the fact is we watched a good Tottenham team in that second half yesterday, or indeed most of the game. It was only really first 10 minutes, last 5 minutes of the first half where we saw sort of batshit mental Tottenham. I feel like there is a good chance that we're going to see a very, very, very good Tottenham Hotspur after this wretched World Cup. So I think there's plenty of reasons to be excited. One of those reasons to be excited is, of course, the Champions League round of 16, the draw of which was made today. As I'm sure everyone knows, we've been drawn against reigning Italian champions AC Milan. First leg is at the San Siro on Valentine's Day. Second leg, weirdly, not to the 8th of March, which feels like ages. Like, is it normally that long that you go between legs? This season is just ridiculous in so many ways. I'm quite thrilled about Milan, and this is for why. So we could have faced Dortmund, who we play every other season, and that's really boring. No thanks. We could have faced Inter Milan, which I was quite convinced was going to be the scenario we were going to get, just for sort of narrative context.
Too much narrative. So, I would have,
They would have been too up for it, sort of taking down their old banks. Leipzig, we could have got, who of course took us apart under Jose in the Champions League tie that no Spurs fan has any memory of. I literally would not be able to tell you anything about either leg of that wretched tie that season. We could have faced Club Brugge, which would have felt very Europa, and thus would have ensured we would have lost. We lose those sort of Europa games, so we absolutely would have lost that tie, and it would have been really embarrassing. No thanks, don't want Bruges. And the other one, PSG, which of course would have been Messi and N17. That would have been incredible. Would have been wild. I'm sure it would have been some insane sort of 9-7 on aggregate sort of madness. But I think if we're being honest, we probably would have been on the wrong end of a 9-7 aggregate defeat. So would have lost that. No thanks. So I'm not mad about getting Milan. It's, I think, the kind of glamour tie you want, but a glamour tie that you can win, which I think is the perfect sweet spot for Champions League football. I feel like Conte will know them back to front from obviously all his Italian days. Plus, he'll be supremely motivated. I'm assuming he doesn't really like Milan, because as a sort of Juve guy who then went on to manage Inter, they're surely in that sort of absolute apex of Conte hatred. So hopefully he's bang up for getting rid of them.
Even with Italians being really weird about sharing managers and players and all that sort of stuff, you'd have to think there'd be some sort of...
Surely they
literally
don't like
played
someone.
For the... Yeah, yeah. Exactly. There's got to be somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. They are a lot more lax about players just moving between rivals just on some sort of merry-go-round. But hopefully Antonio hates Milan, so that's good. And then we've got all our ex-Serie A lads as well. So Romero, Kulusevski, Bentancur, they know all these players, so that'll be good. And there'll be, Kulu and Bentancur particularly, who seem to leave Italian football under a bit of a cloud. You'd imagine they'll be bang up for going back to Italy and showing them just how exceptional their glow-ups have been since joining the Premier League. Tom, you expressed concern about something that was raised when we were chatting earlier. That big bastard, handsome French man that Milan have up front, Olivier Giroud. Talking about narrative, that seems to be the big narrative banana skin that I can think of.
He always scores against us, doesn't he, Giroud? And he is a annoyingly good player whenever you see him. And for France as well, his record for France is mad, isn't it? Also, my favourite thing is that it brings back memories of one of my all-time favourite Spurs moments when Joe Jordan squared up to Gattuso. I had to check, 2011, apparently. But yeah, oh God, Italian.
I'm so mad that was 2011. Years ago.
I feel extremely old, but yeah, hopefully, like BT or someone like reunites them and they have a row in the studio as pundits or something.
Could have been a lot easier. Gattuso could be Spurs manager right now if it wasn't for the online Spurs fan base, of course.
Yeah, that can.
And we would not be playing AC Milan in the Champions League right now, let's be honest.
But yeah, get Joe Jordan on the commentary or something. I loved when, I don't know if Gattuso like underestimate him. He didn't know who he was, didn't realise he was a Scottish hard man. And suddenly I really thought.
Former AC Milan hard man as well.
Yeah, Milan hard man, yeah. Yeah, anyway, 2011, Jesus, where does time go?
It's mad to look at that lineup and think how far we've come, but also just how far we haven't come as well in some ways.
You know, time is a flat circle, guys.
As you said as well, bizarre that we now skip winter and our next Champions League game is in spring. Like, or our next home Champions League game is in March. Like,
it's mad. It's like the fact that the group stage was done and dusted by the 1st of November. And then you don't play again until Valentine's Day in the Champions League. It's just, I mean, we could be looking at, you know, we could be in any sort of shape by then. We could have like five new players or something mad by then. It's just ridiculous.
I love this moment with these competitions, though, where you've made it through and now it's just however many months and you can just enjoy still being in the Champions League. It's like nothing, you can't take that away from me until whenever it is, like the 1st of March, you cannot take it away from me.
And also, I don't think it's worth doing a big Nottingham Forest preview, is it? Because I think like a lot of players are going to be rested.
Well, I was going to ask, like, what would you do both if you were Antonio Conte? I mean, I think logic dictates that you rest a bunch of players. We said earlier, like the Leeds game on the weekend suddenly feels, considering the very up and down Premier League form we've been experiencing, that game feels like a must win. They, you know, they seem a bit on their feet or off their feet, knackered. I can't remember. They're on their feet. They're
scoring goals, Leeds.
Oh, who leads? Yeah. I was talking about us, but yeah, Leeds seem to be scoring goals. I mean, Leeds are... They went to Anfield and won, and then they had that sort of harem scarum. Who did they beat on the weekend? They won 4-3, didn't they?
Bournemouth, they were like 3-1 down and then came back to win 4-3.
We were 2-0 down.
Yeah, exactly. Try harder.
I would put, like, personally, I'd rest like as many as you can, really, for Nottingham Forest in the cup. Like, I couldn't care less about the Carabao. And like you were saying about, like, we're through the Champions League, it'll be nice to have a midweek game that I might not even watch it. Is it on TV? I've literally no idea. Great to have a midweek game that doesn't really matter. Like, if we get Carabao, I don't really care.
It is a trophy. That's all I'd say.
It doesn't matter. Okay, I know it really... And honestly, this is the perfect game for us, I think.
Yeah.
Because we can just rest everybody, just... Whatever 11 we can cobble together from, you know, not Kane, not Kulu, not Bentancur, not Hobbit, all of that gang, right?
Jesus Christ, this lineup, man.
It's going to be hilarious, but, you know. But the thing is as well, the best thing about it is that because it's against Premier League opposition, if we lose, it's not that embarrassing.
No.
So it doesn't matter. So I don't feel like we can lose, actually. And I know it is so entitled of me to say it, but I don't give a fuck about the League Cup. Just, what even is it named after? I don't care. It's
Chinese.
Is it an energy drink?
Yeah.
The fact that I can never even remember that, you know, I know this is genuinely so entitled of me, but whatever, the gods, you know, have wreaked their vengeance upon me already. So I don't know. Why did I say that out loud?
5-1 defeat in the post, thanks to Chris.
I was about to say also there's a lot of players with a point to prove, but with the rogue gallery that we're likely to see, you know, like if we do rest everyone with Sanchez, I mean, Skip's got a point to prove, Brian Hill's got a point to prove, fucking Lucas can run around like a lunatic and with no end product probably.
We're harking back to those like early Conference League games, aren't we? Thinking about some of these lineups. We know when Nuno had his like B team and his A team, yeah. Like this is full B team, I imagine.
Certainly, Spence has a point to prove.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is This could be.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Actually, Spence and Brian. Like, and he
won't start.
Them.
He won't start Spence, will he? Though. He
and Skip's start. Played. Skip's played no football, so he'll want to do something. You'd hope. It's a shame we haven't got Dane Scarlett to start like he did in those.
Yeah, because I guess if you don't play Kane, who do you play up front? Because Richarlison, I don't think's yet ready. Although he did seem quite sprightly jumping off the sofa today when he found out he was in the Brazil squad, which I'm happy for him about, because I know that's a big deal for him.
Did they announce that on telly?
Yeah, I think it's like...
So you don't even get a phone call?
I think in very sort of Brazilian soap opera kind of beautiful melodrama style, they do a full like press conference where they just read the names out, and that's the first the players know about it, seemingly. Because Richarlison had his whole family around his house. And he was in his Brazil shirt as well. I was like, what if he hadn't gone? but hopefully that's a good thing for him. And he, goes and wins the World Cup for Brazil and comes back and scores 15 goals after Christmas. Yeah. That'd be nice.
He might get a few minutes, I guess. But ultimately, it's going to be like Lucas and Brian, isn't it? Like,
We're not winning.
I don't care. Let's just get them out there, run around a bit. Listen, I wasn't wrong when I said it was absolutely fine that we were booted out of the Conference League.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I do remember all of us after the Marseille game last week saying the Liverpool game's irrelevant, doesn't matter. Like we've won the game that matters this week, and then all of us being inconsolable last night. That is not going to happen.
No, point of order. Small correction to that. we didn't say it didn't matter. We said out of the two, if you could only win one, we would take the Marseille game. And I actually stand by that. I would stand by that. That was incredible. To still be in the Champions League, you can't... I just don't want to be another team that's like, we're going to throw the Champions League to be in the Champions League again. That's just, and the players would have felt it exactly. It would have been a nightmare. And how we felt on Tuesday, like we were down and out, man. We're heading to the Europa League to have to play like quite a lot of really good teams. But
I didn't realize as well that we would have had to have dropped into the playoff round.
Oh my God. So not even.
So if you don't get, so say Arsenal, for example, they won their group. So they go through to the last 16. There's a round of 32 rounds that the dropout teams from the Champions League have to play the teams that finish second in the Europa group stage.
Oh my God.
Before they can then get through to the round that Arsenal are in. So we would have had to have. So Barca came out of the Champions League and had to play United, who finished second in their group.
I feel like I've had a vision of my own death hearing that.
And that's what we were staring down the barrel at. Like that could
I'm so glad I didn't know that then. It was bad enough as it was.
If old Kalashnik hadn't, slapped that header, bounced it over the bar.
See, defenders don't know how to score goals. That's the reality. And, Longley got one that night. So,
he did go on.
Like magnificent, magnificent. And I really, again, appreciated the interviews afterwards, of course. So what a glorious night all round, really. I'm just so relieved. I'm so happy to still be in the Champions League. I love that competition.
It's great. And it is lovely that it's weird, but lovely that we've now got to wait, basically November, December, January. It's like 3.5 months or something till we play in it, which is kind of cool in a way.
Yeah. Like the best month of all of our lives was the month between like the end of the season and playing in the Champions League final.
It was wicked. The last week I was just a bag of nerves. I thought actually one of my favourite Spurs experiences ever was the day we beat Norwich to finish fourth, sort of all the way through the summer. I was just like, everything is great. This is just, I don't have to worry about anything. We're just in the Champions League, Arsenal in the Europa League. Turns out that's as good as it's ever going to get. But we won't worry about that.
But we enjoyed it. We did enjoy it. So and this is, enjoy.
We're going to have plenty to enjoy.
Enjoy Wednesday. It's like a midweek game that means nothing, really. Come on.
And actually, just thinking about that was one other thing. And I don't want to kind of go back to the sort of misery of the crowd or anything, or like angry people in general. But I do think that is part of the problem with how where we are now, because every game matters so much that it just makes everybody, like everybody's emotions just get so like amped up that people do need to release. And I don't think they release it in the best way, but I get it, because every game is just so like everybody, you just all feel like you're going to explode, don't you? I just,
yeah.
You know, but when you're at the stadium, it's kind of easier, I guess. But you know, when you're at home and you're just, there's nowhere to go, you're just pacing.
And then at the end, ghastly. You have to just like return to normal life. Yeah. And, you know, we've got a newborn at home, which is amazing. But like, you know, and we've got a 4-year-old. So there's just, I can't just like go off and, you know, sit in the loo for 45 minutes and, you know, send some messages and get it out of my system. You just have to return to your responsibilities, and it's really, really hard. And yeah, I think a lot of us probably are at a point now where it's like, this is all quite stressful. Like every match does feel like way too much, and amping it down. And maybe it's a very good thing that this cursed World Cup is coming around at this time, because we probably do need a bit of a reset, don't we?
Yeah, I was just thinking that actually, is that the World Cup serves as a nice break. And I mean, usually there's plenty of reasons not to care about this World Cup, isn't there? And not to feel as invested as we usually do as England fans. But you've got the club season is just building up to the World Cup, and you're like, wicked, I've got the something to watch this summer. And like, whereas this time it's like, cool, I can switch off about Spurs like over the Christmas month. And yeah, I don't know. I don't feel as invested as I usually do in the England team. And yeah, it'd be quite nice to just have a break from the stress of football.
Have you both, where are you at with sort of, Tom, you mentioned feeling a little detached from this World Cup. I think we're all kind of grappling with certain feelings and emotions and not wanting to be, I mean, I'm like, I don't want to be a hypocrite. So should I just not watch it? Because is that the best thing that I can do as someone that believes in certain things, is to not add my sort of viewing figures to what would be then, you know, deemed a success if lots and lots and lots of people are watching it? I don't know. How do you both feel?
Well, the whole thing is disgusting, isn't it? Like for a start, like just the whole thing is corrupt and disgusting. And it's awful that it's happening in Qatar. But I also, and I've got friends who are going to boycott it, but I also know I don't want to be a hypocrite and like claim that I'm going to boycott it and then, you know,
sneakily be watching South Korea versus someone. Yeah.
I will watch a fair bit of it, but you know, it is tainted. It is awful that it's going ahead and that it's happening. But I'm not going to kid myself that I won't also watch a fair chunk of it.
I think that's where I am. And I'm sort of really, really upset in lots of ways I'm upset that I'm sort of, and this sounds a bit selfish, I guess, but I'm being put in that situation where something I love so much, and I, you know, like all football fans, the World Cup is so much fun. Like there's nothing quite like it. It's incredible. The fact that it's, you know, it is this sort of filthy, tainted tournament now because of where it's being played and why it's being played there and all the other reasons is gross enough. But the fact it's also like, when it is as well, it's just so fucking ridiculous that they're playing it at this time of year in the middle of a football season. But I do think that actually it will serve as a nice sort of, yeah, a nice little sort of break point for some of us to go, do you know what? Like we can detach from football, and if it's on, it's on. And if it's not, then, well, I'm not having to get stressed about club football for a month or two. Rosa, what about you?
Yeah, I think I'm not going to watch it probably. I just
at all
can't.
You're just not going to watch it.
I mean, it's going to be difficult because Ollie and I don't agree on it. I mean, obviously we agree that it's a horrific thing that it's going forward, but I think he feels like it's kind of not on the fans. Like this was like a corrupt decision that was made many years ago, and it's not on us, I guess. I don't know. I should let him speak for himself, actually. But anyway, I think he will watch it. So I guess it will be on in my house. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to do it. I think I will try very hard to not watch it. I'm certainly not going to go and do any of the stuff I would normally do in a World Cup, to like go out and meet people and watch it in a pub or anything and just kind of do that whole thing. Because I think for me, it's not just about this World Cup. It's like, now for me as well, it's like the memory of the last one, which like I feel like I do feel quite implicated in now, because even though I knew, you know, what the kind of current state of Russia, like how it was then and everything that it was already doing in Crimea, and kind of went ahead, and I, you know, and I was a bit like, oh, I don't know, I feel bad, I feel weird about this. And then I just got into it anyway, because, you know, I love football so much and I love watching it, and the World Cup is literally a festival of football, and it's so hard, you know, there's something to watch every day and it's wonderful. But now I just look back and I just think, you know, the thing that we love about the World Cup is all of our memories of the World Cup, right? And all of the amazing places that it's been played in and the amazing teams. And I just think I don't really have those memories of the last World Cup now because of everything. And so I don't feel like I don't even feel really like I would be missing out on anything, I guess, if I didn't watch, because I don't think glorious memories are going to be made there. I think it's going to be something people are going to be so ashamed of in years to come.
The entire thing is disgusting and tainted. And if England do well, it will be tainted. If England go out early, then maybe, you know, it's not going to affect people as much, because actually the human rights abuses and the you know, the corruption puts everything else into perspective. You know, it suddenly makes you think football doesn't actually matter. It's a load of shit. And if FIFA are going to do this to fans, then fuck them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that's really gutting about it is that obviously it happens once every 4 years. So that's it for another 4 years for us all, really. And, I, you know, the Euros are wonderful, but it's not the same, is it? No, when you get to see Argentina, you get to see Brazil and, you know, loads of African teams, and just everybody is there. That's the whole point. And yeah, we have been robbed of that, basically, because I think even if we do watch it, it won't, yeah, we won't have those memories. It won't be, it just won't be joyous the way World Cup should be.
I agree. And it's good to talk about it, because I think we are all feeling conflicted as, you know, as massive football fans who, you know, this should be the celebration to end all celebrations that you get to have every 4 years. And it is so wrapped up in all manner of bullshit that it's just really gross and upsetting. And I'm sure we'll revisit it. But let's move on to stuff less upsetting. I want your culture picks, please. I've so missed being able to do this with you all over the last few weeks. Rosa, what have you been enjoying this week?
I've just been indulging in all my usual stuff, but I read a novel. I read Vladimir by Julia May Jonas, which was, I guess, kind of quite a big hit sort of earlier this year. And I don't, it's one of those weird novels where I'm a bit like, do I really want to recommend it? Yeah, I mean, I think it is, it's very good. It's kind of brilliantly written. I don't, it's about a woman, a professor in a sort of, you know, somewhere in some sort of leafy New England college town, and in her sort of late 50s, and her husband has always kind of had affairs with his students, and that she's kind of known about and understood to be consensual, but then kind of in the current climate, like, for people have started complaining about him, and he's been suspended from his duties. And then she becomes sort of obsessed with a new professor, a younger professor called Vladimir, and his wife, and their relationship kind of goes to some sort of quite weird places. I felt like it was one of those novels where the author was trying really hard to be, to kind of tell me something, but I wasn't entirely sure what it was. So she had a lot to say about kind of current sort of social issues and the sort of generation gap and being a woman and aging as a woman and desire and all of that. But ultimately, which was all quite interesting. And it was also very much like, you're not supposed to like this character either, I don't think. But ultimately, so much of it just kind of hit me in this wave of, like, you know, they just ended up just feeling like Tom and Daisy Buchanan, you know, in The Great Gatsby, and there's that kind of great moment in Gatsby where he, you know, the narrator looks at them and is like, they're just careless people and they just smash things up, people and lives and whatever, and they just walk away and it doesn't matter because they're wealthy. And I ended up just feeling a bit about like that about it, which isn't to say that's not kind of fascinating, like, read, because obviously
sounds like Chelsea Football Club
a little bit. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, so there's sort of something compelling in a way, I suppose. I don't know, I guess. And also something very bleak about it all. It was also one of those books where I wasn't entirely sure if some of it was intentional or not. So this is a person who's been dealing with, you know, with students for many years, but was sort of shocked by some of the conversations that she was having with them about race and gender. And I thought, if you're in that position and you're shocked by this point, I don't find that believable, but perhaps I should find it believable. And that's just like a gap in my awareness. Do you know what I mean? So it was a very interesting novel and I would recommend it, because I'd always be interested to know what other people think about it. But I didn't like it very much, if that makes sense.
I think that's quite a... it's not a frequent take that I sort of take away from whenever I read a book, but it definitely happens more than it does with other sort of pieces of culture, where I don't know if I've like had a great time, but I've definitely, you know, learned something, or I found it compelling, but I've not necessarily had like tons of fun. Maybe it sounds like you've had that sort of experience.
Yeah, it's a bit like, maybe this is something about the sort of solitary nature of writing a novel and then reading it, I guess. It's not, you know how we always say that like tennis players are the most mad of all sports people because they're just out there by themselves for hours and it's they like can't even talk to their coach.
Yeah, it's like tennis players and goalkeepers have a lot of problems.
Yeah, you just think just... you're so weird. How have you done it? So maybe, you know, maybe the sort of experience of novel writing and novel reading is just a bit like that. It's just this sort of intense own thing. So yeah, that's my pick, I guess, this week.
I enjoyed that. Enjoyed that. Tom, I know you've finished watching The Bear now. We watched it in like 2 days when we were on when I was on paternity leave. I am almost embarrassed by how much I enjoyed it, because I feel like it was sort of made in a lab for people like me to just get so het up and, you know, in the weeds about, into everything from obviously like, you know, the writing and the performances and the cast and the setting and the, yeah, and before we even get on to the fact that, you know, that that Kami has like the most desirable sort of menswear capsule wardrobe of the 2020s,
and the sort of like sad boy kind of psychotherapy kind of you know, masculinity thing as well. That's pretty interesting and kind of deep. I really liked it a lot. My only criticism would be that it felt like it took 4 or 5 episodes to get going, to really like you could, because they were 20 minutes, most of them, you powered through them. It got going, it kind of built to a head of steam, to use a chef analogy. and then it was done.
And then and I don't know if it's a good thing that I was left wanting more to such a degree, but I completely agree that it did take a minute to really reach a boil, and then it suddenly is over and you're like, oh, how is this only 8 episodes? Like, the episodes are 20 minutes, 23 minutes long. Like, I deserve more.
The final episode was, I think, 48 minutes or something. It kind of, you had those 20-minute episodes and then it gave you a slightly chunkier finale.
I liked as well how the finale, you really felt like you earned the right to sort of see all the emotional reason, like all the stuff with his brother finally
his
gets
monologue,
unpacked.
His monologue was incredible. At the Al-Anon meeting, so for survivors of people whose relatives are alcoholics or drug addicts, it was a meeting, like an AA type thing. But yeah, that monologue was incredible in that final episode. He was great. I don't know how old he is or haven't seen him in anything else, the lead.
Yeah, what's he called, Rosie? You know, Jeremy, is it Jeremy Allen? Someone?
I can't remember his name, but he was in the American version of Shameless.
Ah, he was very good. Oh, and Desi.
Jeremy Allen White. Yeah. To have Desi back on my screens in such a big way and also in such a memorable.
Yeah.
He's such a scene stealer anyway. But what a performance.
He's kind of hateful, just like Desi. He's hateful.
Yes.
In such a different way.
A different way where like Desi was so wet. And this guy is like very masculine and wants to fight everyone. But yeah, oh my God, it's making me want to rewatch Girls because
Desi and
Marnie are just so fucking good, the pair of them. How did Lena Dunham write such hateful, like amazingly awful characters that you love to hate so much?
Rosie, you have to watch The Bear. I really want your.
Yeah.
You're right.
By all accounts. I've rewatched an episode of Girls like relatively recently. You know, the one where Marnie reconnects with her ex,
Charlie.
Yeah. And it's essentially. It's so good. That was such a good show, man.
That was a really affecting episode because she doesn't find Charlie in a very good state, does she? If I remember.
No, he's a real mess. And then she goes home and like Desi's just sitting there. Tragic.
which reminds me of maybe my favorite episode of Girls, which is when Marnie performs the Kanye song at Charlie's workplace.
No, don't make me go back there. I can't do it. I do like a full body cringe even thinking about it.
It's now sort of the only performance of a Kanye song that feels that you can even talk about.
How times have changed.
Yeah. But Alison Williams is so good. She's great in Girls. She's so, so good.
She's excellent in it, yeah.
She's not been in anything for ages of note. She was in Get Out, and then that was... Am I missing something from the...
No, I think that was it.
Alison Williams oeuvre, but I feel like she's disappeared.
No, what happened to Thingy Mamet, David Mamet's daughter, Shosh?
Shosh, yeah.
I feel like she's been in a few things. She's not going to be short of it. I mean, mind you, neither's Alison Williams, because she's the daughter of... some bigwig as well, isn't she? So.
Yeah, sort of a TV.
Mad how they all got those jobs. Eh?
We're calling them Nepo babies.
Yeah.
Speaking of well-connected people, my other pick is the new Phoenix album, which is, again, the most sort of predictable thing that I could ever recommend because they're one of my, if not my favourite sort of contemporary band, they probably are my favourite contemporary band, actually. Alpha Zuda came out on Friday. It's just really, really good. If you like Phoenix, you'll love this. They're not exactly reinventing the wheel. It's a sort of... I love the fact that it's like the most Phoenix album ever recorded and that they recorded it at the Louvre. Like they were allowed during the pandemic when no one was allowed into it. They were sort of... The Louvre kind of offered them a sort of artist residency and offered to build them a studio. So in they went. When it was shut to the public and just recorded an album. And it's just the most wonderfully French thing ever. And you can kind of hear even a lot of the lyrics talk about sort of very arty artifact type thing. So it's just it's a lovely sort of not exactly deep and meaningful, particularly apart from, you know, the nods to Philippe's. How do you, Philippe, is it Zadar? I'm so nervous about, particularly because of how tragic it was when he died a couple of years ago. But their sort of longtime producer, collaborator, sort of godfather, who was in, oh my God, I've completely had a mind blank. What?
Cassius,
of course. And just sort of godfather of that wonderful sort of French electro scene. He passed away a couple of years ago. And this album is a bit of a love letter to him and the influence that he had on their music. And it's really, really lovely. So I'd thoroughly recommend that. Tom, over to you.
Yeah, I'm enjoying that album as well. And I read today that although Philippe Zadar didn't work on it like he did, I think, every other Phoenix album, Thomas Bangalter from Daft Punk helped them with that album, which is cool.
French Avengers just coming together at the Louvre. Incredible.
Exactly. Why not? I'd like to... I can't play anything, but I'd happily live.
Let me into the loo for a bit, yeah, please.
Exactly. While the rest of the world's locked down, that sounds fun. Yeah, just a novel from me. I finished Colson Whitehead's Harlem Shuffle. I really think he is, one of the best novelists working today, alongside, I don't know, Margaret Atwood and Elizabeth Strout and other people I'm forgetting. But yeah, he wrote The Underground Railroad and then The Nickel Boys, which was just brilliant and really concise and so smart. And then The Harlem Shuffle is kind of, he writes a lot about, all his stories are in some way about race and the Black American experience. And The Harlem Shuffle is set in the late 50s, early 60s in Harlem. And it's a kind of a crime caper, but, in a very amazing way, wraps up a load of social commentary and history and, race history. And, there's loads going on. And I think, like you said, Rosa, I think there's so much to take from it. But what I didn't think while I was reading it is, like, he's trying to tell me something here. It's really the message is woven in. And also what I think is great is that the message is contradictory as well. And the characters are multifaceted and their personalities contradict each other. They contradict themselves constantly, as we all do every day, I think. So, yeah, it was just so, so brilliant. I can't recommend it enough, The Harlem Shuffle by Colson Whitehead.
I'm 100% sold on that now. Yeah, I mean, same. I'd always wanted to read his stuff, actually, and had just never got around to it. And now I'm like, that has to be next up.
If you haven't read The Nickel Boys as well, give that a read. I think they're all like 250, 300 pages. You'll fly through them. But yeah, The Nickel Boys is amazing. And he's just such a smart writer. There aren't, he writes about race and stuff, but there are no easy answers. And like the characters are so multifaceted and interesting.
You should work for a publisher, Tom. That was a good sell. A very good sell. Wicked. Thank you, everyone. It's been such a pleasure to be back. I've loved talking to both of you this evening. Thank you all for listening. Tom and Rosa, thank you for your company. And Rosa, can you see us out, please?
I can, but first I have to say, oh my God, take Arsenal fans' phones and internet access away from them, because Tony Adams has got to be kicked out of Strictly. It's now getting ridiculous. That said, up the Spurs.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.